Righto. Welcome to the podcast, to the Pulse podcast. Let's start again. Welcome to the Pulse podcast, where we talk about abortion and euthanasia and all those delightful topics. Thank you for joining us today, Marianne. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks.
So today we're talking about euthanasia, but first of all, I'd really love just to learn more about you and what you've been doing over the past year.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm the research manager at Maxim Institute. And about a year ago, when we knew there was going to be a review of the implementation of euthanasia completed by the Ministry of Health, started looking into what might be done to critique where we're at now. So the legislation at that point had been in for 3 years, or coming up to 4 years of euthanasia being legal. And I spent quite a few months looking at the ministry's review and looking at what was going on overseas, and also what else we know from the New Zealand context. Mm-hmm. So two of the three review committee members left within the first couple years of it operating, and they had some critical things to say. So I included that and just reflected on where we're at with that. And then over the last couple months, we've had Todd Stevenson's bill put in the biscuit tin. He initially was going to remove the 6-month prognosis. That bill's been rewritten to not only include that, but 25 recommendations from the Ministry of Health's report last year.
Which is really concerning.
So looking at, yeah, and I critiqued some of those in the paper from earlier this year. I'm doing a little more work in, especially in Canada, looking how it's played out there, because the recommendations that the ministry made, the amendments that Todd Stevenson's proposing, would actually create an environment very much like Canada's, but in some ways more liberal. So I'm looking at what's being said about what's going on there and how that would apply here.
That's really cool. So just to get our listeners kind of familiar with what is currently happening in New Zealand in the euthanasia area.
So, as I said, it's been legal for almost 4 years. The main thing that's happening is there's this bill that's been submitted. Now, with members' bills, they may never get drawn. They just might die a death there in the biscuit tin. They
might be euthanized.
Yeah. Yeah, passively. And if it does get drawn, it could be at any point in time.
No,
we don't know when that will happen. The way our, because in Canada, euthanasia came to be legal much earlier in a different way. Court decisions determined that there would be legislation putting parameters around that. And different areas of Canada have slightly different regulations. Here, we have an actual bill that we voted on in a referendum that came in through legislation. And along with that legislation, we had amendments to the Crimes Act, because in the Crimes Act, you have assisting a suicide is not legal. So they had to rewrite some of that. This amendment bill proposes reverting the Crimes Act to its original state, interestingly, and widening access to euthanasia. So we're looking at a possibility of these things happening, which would be similar to what's happened in Canada. We don't know if they will, and if the bill gets drawn, there will be the opportunity to propose different amendments to the End of Life Choice Act.
Which could probably also expand it, I guess, further from what he's already proposing.
I have a feeling he's shooting for more than they're actually going to get, because this is what happened first time around, where they went, okay, we'll draw back on what we actually want to be available and how wide we want access to be, because, and this is an interesting point, what people are okay with and what those who are proposing this legislation and the expansion of it want are not the same.
No, exactly. So what we've seen in New Zealand, like last year, was that there was 472 people euthanized or involved in assisted dying, and the number of applications continues to rise each year as well. which is concerning, and now it equates for, what was it, 1.3% of people deaths in New Zealand is assisted dying. So it's definitely on the rise. And I guess now with those proposed expansions from Todd Stevenson, you know, there could be a lot more.
Yeah.
So what are we seeing in the likes of Canada and stuff like that? I know this is something that you've been doing a lot of reading into.
Canada has one of the highest rates of death from, and keep in mind, there's only a handful of countries that have actually legalized it. So we're in a, I don't know if elite's the right word, pool of countries who have said, yes, the medical profession can be involved in ending people's lives actively. Of those who've legalized it, or non-criminalized it, as in a couple of countries, what they have generally done is legalized assisted suicide, where you can prescribe a drug for somebody that they take themselves. So the Netherlands, Oregon, you can get a prescription for a drug that will kill you. What Canada's done, and very recently the Australian states that have legalized it, and New Zealand, is we've legalized voluntary euthanasia, where a doctor performs it for you. And by and large, I think it's up over 96% of all euthanasia cases in New Zealand are the doctor actively administers it. And it's well over 99% in Canada. Once it becomes normalized, people seem to prefer the legitimacy of having a doctor perform it than what would actually be assisted suicide, which is, here's something poisonous that you take.
What was interesting, though, in that research that came out of the Auckland University earlier this year, was that people were taking, or the doctors were sometimes really struggling to actually insert the needles into people's veins.
Doesn't always work well.
Exactly, yeah. Because these people are often unwell, and so then their veins have collapsed and stuff. And so then, you know, the doctors need to come back the following day with, or, you know, a few days later, once they receive the drugs, with the oral medication. But then that's also not without its complications, and sometimes people are taking like 15 to 30 minutes to die, like choking and gagging, and it's like pretty horrific, really. So this whole like euphemism of where people are like, oh, it's such a peaceful death, and it's like,
yeah, the more you read into it, actually a natural death is more often than not peaceful, in the sense that there's no struggle and agony, and it's not always peaceful when it's euthanasia. So that, I'd say, there's a bit of marketing that's gone on to make it sound like it's just always quiet and peaceful. The difference between legalizing something you take yourself and legalizing a doctor administering it is that the uptake is much bigger. So in Canada, you've got 5% of all deaths and climbing from euthanasia. It's become very normalized that someone will kill you if you get to whatever point. And the point there is actually quite broad now, because they've removed the need for one's death to be imminent. I don't know how much you want to go into that, but it does mean that there are people who are choosing euthanasia who are on wait lists for health services, for housing, for other things that they need. They can access euthanasia much more swiftly. So they're far more supported to die than they are to live.
That's really horrific.
And this is where we get into the issue of, what is it people have actually voted to legalize here in New Zealand? What are their expectations? Because most people, and surveys in Canada, still roughly the same as here, about two-thirds of the population see it being okay in certain contexts. But what those contexts are, by and large, are end of life, suffering, no other options. They see it as, if you get to a certain point, then that should be an allowed option. What they don't like seeing is if somebody, and they're talking about legalizing it for people with mental health needs. So if you've got a mental illness and you're suffering from that, they were gonna legalize it by now. It's been pushed back to 2027 because that opens up so many more cans of worms. People recognize that mental health problems, even if they're ongoing for years and years, there is still hope that something could help. And so we hold that hope for other people. You don't have that hope for somebody who's at the end of a terminal illness. And then the debate comes to, is it morally right or wrong to take their life? But everybody understands that the suffering is actually terminal. when you take away the terminal nature and there is hope that somebody could get better housing, somebody could get a treatment that helps, people in Canada are being offered it. There was a woman who was going in for a mastectomy and the doctor brought it up then. Like, instead of going through the surgery, have you considered? So, I mean, that's a hugely different mindset to exceptional circumstances, end of life, shortening suffering. We're talking about people who are not physically suffering. We're talking about people who could be treated, who could have, you know, the housing issues that they're facing addressed before the next bitterly cold Canadian winter starts.
Exactly.
And most people, when they look at that in this survey, the demographic who is most likely to support euthanasia, 80-odd percent, so higher than the average, and that demographic tends to be white, wealthy, and secular. High proportion of those who fit those demographics in favor of it, much more likely to access it themselves. However, in this survey, when they were presented with actual cases that reflected actual stories of people who had other needs that weren't being met, who'd accessed euthanasia, they had the lowest support rate of what was like 6-7% went, yeah, they should be able to access euthanasia for that. They call it MAID in Canada.
Yeah.
Most of them said no. Though they support it generically, specifically in these instances, they were against it.
I think in New Zealand, like from people that I've spoken to, like a lot of people that I've spoken to who voted in the referendum, they just thought they were voting on, do we support the idea of assisted dying?
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, you know, I guess so. If, you know, someone wants that, then we should be supporting it. You know, whereas they didn't realize that we're voting on a specific law, you know, which is now in effect and doesn't have a lot of safeguards. It's, I mean, I remember when we were actually discussing the law just right at the beginning stages, like years ago, you know, it was like, this is like a couple of page kind of document, whereas like a lot of laws overseas are like pages and pages and pages of stuff, you know, like it's a very basic kind of, you know, wording. It's like, there's not a lot of safeguards and protections really in it. And then obviously now, you know, we also kind of were like, what about the slippery slope and all of that? And people were like, no, 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 that's not going to happen. Well, where are we seeing it now? Where are we seeing, you know, Todd Stevenson wanting to take things? I think people in New Zealand are probably similar to what they're experiencing in Canada.
Yeah. But it often comes down to them understanding what is happening on the ground, because on paper we have safeguards. In reality, the registrar who takes the tick boxes that the GP sends in and goes, yep, that looks fine on paper, that doesn't mean that that person hasn't been coerced. It means someone thinks they haven't been. They're supposed to, according to the legislation, do their best to make sure they haven't been coerced. The doctor's free to interpret that how they want. And the more they do, there's evidence, the more kind of tick boxy it becomes. The less likely they are to actually ring up family and talk to them and find out what's going on here. Ring up the care home and talk to somebody who's been, you know, caring for that patient for a year or two and find out what's happening. I know they don't do that normally. Talking to somebody who works in a hospice in Auckland, and she actually, she was fine with it being legal, but she's not fine with the way that the safeguards aren't actually keeping people safe.
Mm.
Of the 80-odd people who they'd had apply for euthanasia from where she worked, they only fielded a handful of calls from the assessing doctors. The vast majority don't even call up those who are caring for them to get more information.
Yeah, exactly.
So on paper, we've got safeguards and people checking things, but if you look at what they're checking and how that information comes to be there, there's actually no assurance, and there's actually evidence that it is happening, that people who are not actively choosing euthanasia are able to access it. The proposed amendments would make even more people eligible or liable to be put in that pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And even more so because this legislation proposes allowing doctors to suggest euthanasia to patients.
Which is deeply concerning.
Yeah. And it's worded as this is an accessibility issue. If people don't know it's an option, then that's a violation of consumer rights. However, consumer rights don't really apply here in the same way that they do when you're buying a car. First of all, most people know that euthanasia is legal. It's been in the news for years. And secondly, the risks to people who don't want the suggestion to end their life are actually quite high. And again, literature from overseas where this is happening commonly shows the damage it does to people, some of whom are repeatedly offered euthanasia. Now, if you're dealing with a health issue, you're being treated and every single physician you come across brings it up again, that's going to take a toll on you mentally and emotionally. Totally. And that's not good healthcare. This is not a consumer rights issue. This is just simple, good psychological care of your patients. Suggesting people end their lives is not something that doctors should be doing.
Mm.
This bill would push that open. The recommendations from the Ministry of Health don't just suggest that be allowed, but that it be encouraged so that everybody knows that this is an option.
It's like we wouldn't go around conversations with people if we just removed the word assisted from, you know, that assisted dying, being like, oh, have you considered suicide? It's like, that would be like probably reported to the police kind of thing, right? Like, but then suddenly when it's a healthcare and it's assisted suicide and it's, you know, then suddenly that's okay. Like, I just don't get it.
Yeah. And I mean, if you put it in the classification of another healthcare procedure, then you go, why not? Well, there are plenty of reasons why not. Listening to stories of people who struggling because it keeps being suggested to them, that in itself is evidence that this is not normal healthcare. Mm. So they put it in the wrong classification, the ministry in their review, and Todd Stevenson in his bill, and it would change the whole nature of healthcare. And when you read stuff from Canada, where this is commonplace, you've got military veterans, many of whom are dealing with PTSD, and it turns out this is, they said it was just an isolated event of a number of them being offered MAID when they were on wait lists for other healthcare, mental health care. And some of them were objecting. Saw testimony from one woman yesterday who just gave testimony before a select committee in Canada. And she is angry because this, and she said, is still happening. They said, oh, it's isolated, it's been taken care of. And she said, no, we've got a high rate of suicide already among returning military personnel. We are not being cared for, again, systemic failures where the health system is not meeting everybody's needs. And instead we're being offered assisted suicide.
Mm.
There are plenty of people who object to that.
I think most of us would.
Yeah.
People who have served our country and were like, did you want the cheaper way out? I mean, is it a cost thing? Like, is it?
Once you start looking into what the different incentives are along the chain, you can become quite cynical because it is, it's a cheaper option.
Mm.
And it's being presented as a more compassionate option because you look at somebody who's got housing needs that aren't being met, somebody who's waiting for a wheelchair ramp for several years and then was offered assisted suicide. And you go, well, at least they wouldn't be suffering. This is the argument. And suddenly that becomes compassionate because these other needs aren't being met. Well, at least we can offer them this option.
Mm.
I hope that in New Zealand we don't get to the point where that's seen as compassionate.
No, exactly.
Opening it up beyond people who are, you know, whose death is reasonably foreseeable to those who are not terminal, it quickly goes to that territory of, well, other options aren't panning out. At least they've got this option. But that's not an option. That erases all other options, you know?
Exactly.
Other treatment doesn't negate different types of treatment.
Totally.
You can take chemo and still be, you know, eligible for surgery. If you opt for assisted suicide, you don't need that house. You don't need the surgery. You don't, like, it's all off the table. It's the end of choice.
No, exactly. Now, I guess, like, for a listener who's listening today and they don't really know where they stand on the thought of, like, is assisted dying okay? Like, what do I actually believe?
Yeah.
What would some of the arguments that you would give to them for why they should be opposed to it be?
And this comes down to what somebody's worldview is.
Mm.
So if your worldview is that we are just material, like anything that's material, when it's served its time, you throw it out, you know? Turn it to nature. I think with that worldview, it's much easier to accept, which is why those who are secular are much more likely to agree with it being legal. And for those people, I think what they need to do is just have a look at how it's playing out in Canada. The proof's in the pudding. The pudding here is that vulnerable people have become more vulnerable.
Mm.
So in Canada, they now have track one made and track two made. Track one, their legislation was similar to what ours is now, where death had to be reasonably foreseeable. It was, I think, wider than 6 months there. Some doctors interpret that as up to 10 years. Anyway, have a condition that was actually actively killing you. That was the idea. Other conditions like dementia and stuff slip in there, and people, physicians in Canada would call that track one. Track one got opened up about 4 years ago to track two. So now people can apply for euthanasia if they're suffering, if they have decline, very similar to what Todd Stevenson's bill is proposing.
Mm.
Now, people who have disabilities can apply. People who are vulnerable for different reasons, but whose death isn't imminent, can apply. When they break down the applicants for track one and track two, people are far more likely to be vulnerable for different reasons. And when you get into things like housing disadvantage, employment disadvantage, old age, you are multiple times more likely to be dying from track two made than from track one. Many times more likely than the general population to be dying from made. And what it shows is the most vulnerable are the most likely to be track two, not imminent death, applying to end their lives.
Mm.
These are people whose lives are hard anyway. Even if you think that this is all there is, that highlights the fact that there's an inequity here. Here are people who can't access things that if you had more money, if you lived in a different neighborhood, things would be easier. And they would, because you look at the stats, be less likely to be applying to end their lives. So we've got an equity problem there. Opening it up to allowing people to end their lives when things get too hard most disadvantages the most vulnerable. So I think that right there is a good argument for everybody to take a second look at this. If you believe that life, as we do, is given by God and we're made in His image and He is the one who can take life, then I think it's much clearer. It means that you'll still have to wrestle with suffering and the meaning of suffering and how we help people who are suffering. There are huge questions that need answering. And there will be situations that you can point to that are not ideal. But the question of is actively ending the life better has already been answered, because that's not our job. That's playing God. So all of the other answers, nothing is ideal, but that one is not ideal because it's actually not our job to end lives. So I think the other arguments are supportive, but it's a much simpler decision because of who we believe creates and takes life.
No, exactly. Yeah, all life has value. And then there's also like the arguments around, our response to be a response of care, not of,
yes,
harming. And in New Zealand, what we're seeing is they'll fly a euthanasia doctor to wherever you are in the country. So it's, open access to everyone, equal access. Whereas like if you've got cancer and you're wanting a hospice, palliative care specialist,
no,
you're not going to get someone if you're not in the right locations, which is, so we don't actually have equity of care really in New Zealand.
No.
And then when we're opening it up, then that's when, like you're saying, the coercion really opens up and, people are going to be more likely to feel that pressure or be coerced by family members and stuff. And if you allow it for some, then others feel that burden like, oh, it's available, so I should be accepting it, I should be using it, which is, just like that whole psychological kind of thing where it comes into a big, and then there's a slippery slope, and it's just like we're seeing expand in Canada, we're seeing the start of expanding here in New Zealand, and where is it going to head? And we don't want that for our country, where we've become a country where we're saying, you're not perfect and let's offer you a way out, in which society has it ever worked out well?
Yeah, anytime we decide this person's life is worth living and this person's is not. And like you said, it sends a message to everyone else. as soon as you open it up to people with disabilities, and I mean, it's already open to people who have conditions that other people with the same condition, they still want to go on living. They don't want to be told, oh, we won't stop you if you want to commit suicide. Mm. That person we will, you we won't.
Mm.
If we open it up to even more people, that is sending the message to people with disabilities, with chronic conditions, that you might be better off dead. And even if they want to keep on living, there's that attitude now that maybe I should be choosing to end my life. And again, literature from overseas, so many examples of people who've been put in that situation. Unfairly, they're dealing with enough without having to think, maybe it'd be easier for my family, it'd definitely be cheaper for them if I chose to end it now.
Mm.
People should not have to be making that decision.
No, exactly. It's concerning, isn't it? Any final closing thoughts?
Oh, I could be here all
day, you know?
I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind, I'm going to go with two, actually.
Perfect.
If this bill goes through, there will be no euthanasia-free zones. This legislation is supposed to be about free choice. However, it wants to, as I said, allow doctors to raise it with patients. So patients will not have the guarantee that somebody won't be asking them to think about ending their lives.
Mm-hmm.
It will mandate all care facilities. So this is rest homes, hospices, anywhere somebody is cared for medically.
Will be private hospitals too.
Private hospitals, yes. To allow it on site. Well, that means nobody who lives in a rest home will have the option to live somewhere where their neighbor isn't getting assisted suicide. It means that no healthcare worker will be able to work in an environment where people aren't being actively killed on their wards. I know for a fact that there are hospice patients who have chosen not to be admitted to the one hospice in New Zealand that does allow it on site for that reason.
Mm.
People have been exercising the choice to go elsewhere. If it's mandated, that choice will be removed from all patients, all elderly everywhere.
And there was that story of that, was it a hospice in Canada?
Yes. Now, it isn't written into the legislation what will happen if a facility says, no, it's not happening on site.
Mm.
But there was one in Canada, that charitable one. So this is not government operated. This is people have donated money, opened a hospice. And because they wouldn't allow it on site, the state actually took it over. So this charity lost their hospice and the right to run it for not allowing it on site, which seems ridiculously heavy-handed. The legislation here, it doesn't rule anything in or out.
Mm.
But if it passes, there will be repercussions. And it means that privately run, faith-based, or any other worldview-based institution won't have the autonomy to make that decision.
Mm.
Which, the argument is, it's an access issue, you can't deny people access. However, if this is about choice, people can choose to go to the hospices and the restrooms where it is offered if that is what they want. And conversely, people who don't want that should have the option to go to places where it's not offered. So this bill is suggesting a huge overreach. And as we've seen in Canada, it will undermine the operation of these places. The other thing I'd say is the one hospice that does allow it on site here lost staff, quite a number of staff, when it made that decision. The entire care sector would be under pressure if they were mandated in this way. And if they have nowhere else to work, some people will actually leave the workforce, because having people actively killed in a workplace is something that many, many health professionals did not sign up for and will not stick around for. We've got a workforce that's already under pressure. Mandating that in every corner of the health sector would not be helpful. So this bill would do that. The other thing I'd say that I don't think is generally known, but the UN's Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities has come out and stated that Track 2 made in Canada should be repealed.
Oh, really?
They see this as violating human rights for those with disabilities. If this bill passes, removing the six-month prognosis, we would also fall under the category of the UN itself is saying this violates the rights of persons with disabilities. So this isn't just a certain segment of society saying this is taking it too far. You've got international bodies like the UN weighing in and saying this is not what people have signed up for.
No, exactly. That's really interesting. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. We appreciate you coming along and joining today to discuss all of this stuff. It's a heavy topic, but I think it's an important conversation and one that, you know, like we don't necessarily have often enough.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's great that we can actually just discuss it and work through some of those different aspects of it. So.
Thanks, Lydia. It's my pleasure.
The Pulse podcast is brought to you by Voice for Life New Zealand. If you enjoyed this show and you think that having a strong pro-life voice in the public square is essential, then please support this podcast and all of the other important pro-life work that Voice for Life is engaged in at voiceforlife.org.nz/donate. That's voiceforlife.org.nz/donate. Link in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on The Pulse.